There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it. There you go. With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 1034, March 4th, 2024. Nasser.
Thank you, sir. I say Max, large and in charge. He can go 55. Christian Horner is gingerly free of all charges. Maybe not so fast. Jos the boss throws him under the bus. And we have PV German in the palatial studios. We shall explain gladly. Back to you, Mr. Rogers.
Thank you, Nasser. On today's program, Max picks up right where he left off. With authority, while Joss, the boss, wants Horner out of Red Bull, and he is suspected of sending the leaked email. Aston Martin have lost their certain je ne sais quoi from 2023. LCH a bit disappointed with his Merc, but I think they'll bounce back. And Alpine begin to implode with key personnel quitting left and right. And this week's interview, straight from Germany, the founder, the owner of GrandPrix247.com, Mr. Paul Velasco. Nasser will have all the details on that. And we do need, indeed, your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you'll want to. I want to thank James Grant for your support. Thank you very much. And I want to mention our merchandise page does have knickknacks that help keep us in the black. Nasser, a lot going on. Max is on fire. Welcome to the studio. How are you?
Thank you, sir. And of course, Mr. Rogers, before we get into racing action, a few words before Games Without Frontiers and War Without Tears, if there is such a thing. The caca show that is going on with Red Bull, investigation into allegations of inappropriate behavior by their team principal, is like a fever that just won't go away. You know what I'm saying? Yes, in very good news for Formula One, at least at the time, Christian Horner is clean as a whistle on Platform 1 at Victoria Station. Now, this was according to a statement from Red Bull, the parent company of Red Bull Racing, and they said that the claimant has the right of appeal. I just hope checkered flag has been waved on this issue once and for all, and what happened between the two parties does not remain part of public inquiry, or as Mr. Mark Knopfler would say in a song, remain private investigation. I thought this was the end of it, and we will move on with life as we know and love it. Life called Formula One, but not so fast. Now, just as somebody was out to get Max in the basement, we're talking Max Mosley here, looks like somebody is out to get Horner through the internet environment. I am sure everybody listening already knows that an anonymous sender has sent what is to be copy-paste messages between Christian Horner and the lady. And I understand one of the publications has now gone on to print the name of this lady also, who made the allegations against him. Now, whether this is authentic or not, and there are photographs also, I do not know at this time. But I think Red Bull and FIA / Formula One should put this issue to rest for the sake of what we all love. And the latest, as you said, Jos the boss has stated, Red Bull team will explode if Horner stays at the team. No love lost between the Dutch JV and CH. Now, I heard that Yoss has been PO'd at Christian Horner, as Christian was against putting Max in Red Bull team at the 2016 Spanish Grand Prix, and we all know what happened after the two Silver Arrows crashed into each other. So this was kind of news to me. What started out as an internal he said, she said complaint is now getting down and dirty and personal. Definitely not good for the sport, not good for Red Bull brand. Now this is interesting. According to one publication, the Austrian side of Red Bull, which includes Oliver Minzlaff, the CEO, and the son of Dietrich Mateschitz, Mark, they had prepared a statement ready to go, removing Christian Horner from the team, but a last-minute letter from Christian Horner's lawyer pointed to a clause in his contract that any and all issues must be resolved through arbitration. Looks like, and this again is widely reported, Horner has the support of the Thai side of the Red Bull ownership. They have a 51% share in the parent company. They are the majority owners. And I don't think this issue is going away before the next round, which is this weekend in Saudi Arabia. Your thoughts and suggestion for resolving this issue, Mr. Rogers?
It's really simple. Christian Horner has to resign, and I predict he will resign because this is now snowballed. It's going to be gnawing at his ass until he leaves. And if everything else goes wrong, we'll see Max holding hands with Toto.
Well, I think that will be a good idea starting 2026, because as long as Honda is there and Adrian Newey there, they're going to be winning races and championships, but time will tell. Now, second point is the pre-race press conference. Only one man steals the show every time he opens his mouth, our favorite, eternal favorite, El Machismo. Now, as can be expected, he was asked about Lewis keeping his seat warm at Mercedes during this season. He said first he has to decide if he wants to stay in Formula One. Like he doesn't care for a seat at a top team. I think as a race fan, he should go for it. What do you think as a Nando fan?
Of course. I mean, I think he could end his career at Mercedes if Toto allows it, but the other thing is they're looking at their new little Kimi. And Kimi, he did good this weekend, last weekend. But my favorite new driver is Zany Maloney, who was on fire. So we'll see what happens. Kimi might not be able to get up to speed as quickly as we need him to. Thus, we have El Machismo. And Machismo's contract does end this year.
Yes. Replacing Lewis at Mercedes will be headlines all over the Motorsports Mondial. Fans will have the luxury of another case of cage rattling, and we all know how much we love cage rattling here in the Palatial Studios. And Alonso will have one last opportunity for burning down the house. I think all season long, Machismo will have the Rockville feeling, somebody's watching me. And who are you watching this season, Mr. Rogers, apart from Alonso and Max?
That's all I watch is Alonso and Max. I mean, let's face it. But you have to give it to this season opener. Not one yellow flag. Everybody finished the race. Logan Sargeant was exactly where I expected him to be. I mean, there was not much going on except for Ricciardo and Tsunoda having a tiff. But it was pretty much 2023 part two. And it was just so funny to watch as Max finished 22 seconds ahead of his teammate.
Oh, of course. And sir, let's do a quick quickie on the quali situation. Hopes were very high for change of scenery at the top after red cars topped the timing sheets after Q1 and Q2. First, it was hit the road jack, Carlos Sainz Jr. with time of 129.909. Now, the slowest time in Q1 was recorded by the Alpine of Pierre Gasly at 130.948, so which is, you know, 1 second slower. And that's what you would expect between the fastest and the slowest. And in Q2, it was Prince Charming of Monaco, Charles Leclerc. He went faster than Carlito with a time of 129.165. And the slowest time in Q2 was recorded by K-Mag, Kevin Magnussen, in a Ferrari-powered Haas. His time, 130.529. This is where I need your help. It was no surprise one of the Aston Martins also made it to Q3. Who can it be now, Mr. Rogers? Help me make it through the podcast.
Yeah, and it's funny because Lance looked very competitive during some of the practice, FP1, FP2. He was keeping up with Fernando. He completely lost it in quali, but yes, same old, just like last year. I'm loving it.
But anyone with eyes wide open since Abu Dhabi 2021 knew what was coming. And there it was, pole number 33 for car number 33, if it was not number one. You know, Max has decided to use number one as world champion. And number 33 pole position matches the pole record of Jim Clark and Alain Prost. And Max's pole winning lap was 129.170. And Mr. Rogers, let's not forget, Emperor Maximilian is a few years away from being 30 years old. So he is on a super fast train, bullet train, I should say. Now, the fight to be number one behind Max is close, but I was very impressed by Nico Hülkenberg making it to Q3 in a Haas. He was 10th on the grid with a time of 130.502. And sir, I think Nico Hülkenberg is the only GP2/F2 champion in this modern era who won the championship in his rookie season and did not land at a top team. Anything else you saw in quali that you would like to talk about before we move to the race?
Well, very true. I was very impressed with Hülkenberg. He can take a piece of crap, get it to Q3, and he was up there. On the other hand, what was really interesting is Max's time, because he was a full 6/10 faster than pole position 2023 in Bahrain last year. So Max continues to move forward, and the car is very quick.
Yes. Now we go to the race. As Mr. Andy Williams says in a song, where do I begin to tell the sweet love story that's older than the sea? How long does it last? I say it will last all season long in 2024 and in the year 2025. And Mr. Rogers, I've been traveling, and I will be for the next few days, so I could only watch the last few laps in a taxi ride. But it's not unusual to see Max beat his own teammate by over 20 seconds. Given the circumstances and what he's up against, I think Checo did the best job he could do, got the car home in second place to give the team maximum points from the opening round. And of course, not surprisingly again, Max set the fastest lap also. As Christian Horner said last year about Checo, just drive the car. That car is good enough for a podium finish on a bad day. The question is, why give yourself race weekend meningitis in trying to beat Max or trying to reinvent the car every weekend? As Dr. Marco complained of Pierre Gasly, you're not going to beat Max. It's as simple as that. Now, as someone once said, Adrian Newey can see the wind flow. And I think it was Will Buxton who said that. He has definitely done his mojo once again. And again, no surprise here. I think their 2024 package, at least from one showing, is so strong, Red Bull can win the Drivers' Championship with Checo if Max switches to Polo in Saudi Arabia. Now, Maestro Fangio believed in winning the race at the slowest speed, while Jim Clark thinking was, murder them at the start. And that's what Max has done after race one. He has removed every team's Pandora box from the paddock. Now, the real scary part is, and this is just my personal opinion, I think even if Ferrari and Mercedes put on the grid equally competitive cars against the Red Bull, advantage is still with Max. He is damn good, very aggressive as and when required, and on a serious hot roll. I just cannot see anybody, including Lewis and Alonso, beat him to the championship, or if all cars are equal. Maybe they can beat him in a few races for sure. Now, speaking of LCH, after quali, the team said they had to sacrifice quali pace for race setup. This, to me, was Oxford Greek. Translation to simple English was, our car is not as fast as Red Bull. Or for Hemi haters, the translation was, Lewis is not as quick as Max. And who can argue with this situation, given the race-winning situation that Red Bull and Max has been putting, and Lewis has not won a race since 2021. Max is definitely cool hand Luke of Formula One these days. What we have here is a failure to compete. let's look at the suffering of the chain gang. His own teammate in the same car was 22 seconds behind. As someone said on the interweb, sorry for the fans in the grandstand to wait so long for the runner-up. And, you know, actually somebody posted on YouTube, one of those, you know, who had a video or a cell phone video that he took of the checkered flag being waved for Max, and then it is a long, long wait for the second car. Third man on the podium, riding a prancing horse, was 25 seconds behind. Now, this is which was interesting for me. The Ferrari number one for one more season was fourth and incredibly 39 seconds behind Max. Looks like the prancing horse still in the barn, but out to lunch. The other teams have a lot of catching to do, and by the time they reach there, I think we will be in the second half of the 2025 season. And no, that's not a typo. That's what I think. To borrow a phrase from Jim Cramer of Mad Money, the rest of the season will be house of pain for 19 drivers. And I say, Mr. Rogers, more power to Max, more energy to Red Bull, and of course, more power and reliability to GP2 engine. I think Honda should invite Zach and Nando for a nice lunch with sake and wasabi. Konnichiwa, baby. Be careful what you wish for. Just might come true, but with another team. What say you, senor?
I still think that there's a chance for other teams to win, especially Ferrari. Ferrari looks like they had a quick car. And, you know, Leclerc, I think, eventually is going to get a reputation of always whining and complaining, using that to have an excuse on why he can't perform while his teammate is kicking ass. So I'm not sure what's going on. They need to settle it. I think Leclerc is a bit hammered, no pun intended, with Hamilton coming over next year. It's already eating at his gut. People are uncomfortable. So there's a lot of discomfort everywhere. Red Bull, Ferrari. I don't know what's going on at Mercedes, but with Lewis Hamilton and his last season there, that's going to get really touchy and feely, and he'll be left out of a lot of technical meetings in a few months. So it's going to be a strange season. And yes, Max will dominate. And we should get used to it, because 2026 is still a few moments away.
Yes, sir. And speaking of Leclerc's teammate, Carlos Sainz Jr. is on his way out of the team at the end of the season. So it was good to see him on the podium. And I'm sure his agenda for rest of the season will be to beat his teammate and land himself a good ride for 2025. And I remember how impressive Carlos Sainz was when he joined Ferrari. He hit the ground running. Leclerc finished fourth. After the race, he said he was happy with the pace of his car. And I agree with you, him and Ferrari and Carlos sooner or later will win a race or two. But according to Mr. Leclerc, he was struggling with brake issues, especially in turns 9 and 10. The top Mercedes was fifth, and it was not even LCH. George Russell, who rattled the cage of his then-teammate Valtteri Bottas at the same track some years ago, crossed the finish line 46 seconds behind the race winner. Now that is some distance. And that was the top five. Then came Norris, Hamilton, and Piastri. The golden boy of Briatore, and muy mucho hombre de viva España, Dios of Clark Rogers, Fernando Alonso. He collected 2 points by finishing ninth, only 1 minute and 14 seconds behind the new Super El Machismo Max. Whatever happened to their form from last year? The final point from 10th place went to the hardest working man in Formula One. I was very impressed. Daddy's little Jim Clark, also known as Lance Stroll. Now, every driver outside the points finished a lap down, except for Logan Sargeant, who was 2 laps down at the end of the race. Chinese driver Guan Yu Zhou was 11th. His teammate Valtteri Bottas was 19th after a Ferrari-style long pit stop. Haas drivers finished 12th and 16th, K-Mag and Hülkenberg respectively. Ex-team principal and many people's favorite Gunther Steiner was in the paddock as a reporter for German Network, and he was asked if he had run into team owner Gene Haas, who was apparently also at the race, and the answer was no. Visa Cash App RB cars were 13th and 14th, Daniel Ricciardo ahead of Yuki Tsunoda, and they had their own issues on the cool-down lap, but what do you expect from Yuki? Alex Albon was 15th for Williams. This once-proud team and very successful team has now become the English version of Alpine. And I have to say, oh, Claire, where have you gone? Sir, talking of Ricciardo and Tsunoda's situation, do you have any comments on that?
Well, everybody expected RB to all of a sudden be the dark horse and might be competitive. Guys, they're still in Faenza, Italy. It's really still Minardi. So everybody just relax, especially Zach Brown. They are not the Red Bull team. They're not even close to the Red Bull team, even though they do get access to some tech wizardry. Definitely not a threat for anybody. So I don't know why everybody was crying about that. And Alpine, they're here to make Williams look good.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you know what is interesting of all that's going on? Red Bull adopted the concept Mercedes gave up after 2 years of trying, and they have hit the ground running and stomping all over the competition from round one. Now, one wonders what upgrades will do to RB20. I just hope we don't see the embarrassment of third man on the podium being a lap down on Max at the end of a bone-dry race. And speaking of your fellow Francais team, Alpine, I think they are on the Tom Petty program, Free Fallen. Their latest L-plan, I don't know how many L-plans they have gone through, is spiraling down after both Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly finished a lap down. One driver finishing a lap down, you can come up with some excuse, but both very bad. But wait, there's more. Here comes the news right after the race. Both technical director Matt Harmon and head of aerodynamics Dirk De Beer, who is very well known in the F1 circles, have submitted their take this job and shove it notices.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it.
Both are expected to leave the building next month. And I say, bonjour, Monsieur Michael Andretti. Please pick up the white courtesy phone, or maybe it's the French Racing Blue courtesy phone. Mr. Rogers, would you like to see Renault CEO Luca Di Meo pull the plug and take Alpine team out of its misery?
Why not? I mean, I'm a big Renault fan, but really Renault as a company has really, really gone in the electrification mode in terms of regular transportation. And for some of these companies, even Mercedes, I mean, building these PUs or power units becomes a little passé because the road cars are doing nothing but electricity. So it's weird. It's a strange shift in the automotive world historically. And we'll just have to keep our eyes open and see what happens. But Formula One racing might have some issues in the very near future, even though electrification is waning a little bit and people are taking a second look at the hybrids. So, to be honest with you, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, and what do you make of what happened with the only Amerikanski in Formula One, Logan Sargeant?
I'm not sure. And when you saw Williams seeing what he had just done, I mean, he just sort of stopped in that runoff area. I'm not sure why. It was like he had a brain fade, and then all of a sudden he came back to life and he rebooted himself. But you could tell, I saw that face at Williams, and you could tell, did we make the right decision? I think the biggest problem here is nice guys finish last. And I know they were being nice to Logan, and he's going to have another season, but I don't think it's going to add up to a big pile of beans.
Yeah, you know, last year one can say he was rookie and Formula One is so tough and lack of testing, which is all true, but he has done over 20 races. This year he cannot have any excuses. And I have a feeling that if he continues with this way, then I will not be surprised if he gets the Nick DeVries treatment from Williams, even though there's a lot of money coming in through his family connections. But we wish everybody all the best. Hopefully he can get it going. But I really just cannot see him catching up to challenge Alex Albon, his teammate.
I concur. And on that note, Nasser, we need to take a little break. We've got a big interview coming. So, folks, we'll be back after these brief messages.
Hi, I'm Marcus Ericsson. You're listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial, with the king, the Swami himself, Nasser Hamid.
Thank you, sir. And Formula 2 and Formula 3 seasons also started in Bahrain. So let's take a look at last frontier before the promised land of Formula 1, which will be Formula 2. Interesting story here. Indian driver Kush Maini took pole position, which was later taken away on technical infringement. This promoted Brazilian Gabriel Bortoleto, who I believe is managed by Alonso, to the top of the grid. Sharing the front row with him was French-Algerian driver and Red Bull Junior Isaac Hadjar. Ex-Red Bull Junior and young man from Dallas, Jack Crawford, moved up to 10th on the grid, which gave him pole position for the sprint race. And since the Grand Prix was on Saturday, the sprint race took place on Friday. Winner was boy from Barbados, Zane Maloney. This kid is making a big name for himself. He started from 8th on the grid. Jack Crawford from Dallas was second, and Spaniard Jose Maria Marti was third man on the podium. Feature race, double the pleasure for Maloney. This is the first time since the start of the GP2/F2 era in 2005 that both the opening races have been won by the same driver. So keep up the good work to Mr. Maloney. And just as a point of reference and factoid on GP2, Habidas, the first ever race was won by Heikki Kovalainen, and the first ever champion was Nico Rosberg, and that would be in 2005. Now, Senor Marti, his nickname is Pepe, also got his second podium of the weekend by finishing second in the feature race, and Paul Aron from Estonia was third. The pre-season hype master Andrea Antonelli, the Italian Kimi, had a low-key start to his maiden F2 season. He only scored a single point from the weekend from his 10th place finish in the feature race, but it's a long season and I do expect him to bounce back soon, or Toto will be calling old man of the sea to replace LCH. Zane Maloney now leads the championship from Josep Marti, 36 to 24 points, and round 2 is this weekend in Saudi Arabia, Jeddah. Now we move on to next step, which is Formula 3. Man on pole, Dino Beganovic, who is Swedish of Bosnian heritage and also a Ferrari junior driver. Sebastian Montoya is also racing in this series. For the opening round, he qualified towards back of the grid. And based on performance so far in Europe, looks like this apple did not fall near the tree. And that apple tree is very famous, you know, as we all know. The first F3 race of the season took place again on Friday. Impressive win for Arvid Lindblad of UK. We interviewed him last year at Monza, at the Monza Formula 4 race. Winning on your debut in a high-profile new series is always a plus for young drivers. Arvid is only in his second year of single-seater racing, so that's very good. He is a Red Bull Junior, Papito from Sweden and Mamito from India. Second was Dutch driver Lorenz van Hopen, with Italian Leonardo Fornaroli third. American Max Esterson was sixth. He comes from Sims racing background. And Mini Monty, Sebastian Montoya, finished solid 18th. Now, man who took pole position for Sunday's feature race, Dino Beganovic, suffered a puncture on the opening lap and was the last car running at the end of the race. British driver Luke Browning, who dominated the Macau Grand Prix late last year, was the winner. Aussie mate Christian Mansell was second. German Tim Tramnitz was third man on the podium. And Mr. Lindblad, Arvid Lindblad, winner of Friday's sprint race, was eighth. Beganovic fought the good fight but was unable to salvage any points after running out of luck in both races and finishing 13th in the feature race. Championship position. After round 1, Luke Browning leads from Tim Tramnitz 25 to 21 points. And their second round is not in Saudi Arabia, but in Albert Park on March 23rd and 24. Now we move on to WEC, World Endurance Championship. High sales for Porsche at Losail Circuit in Qatar. Now I must say, very smart of FIA to schedule the opening round of World Sports Car Championship on the same weekend in nearby Doha, Qatar, or Qatar as the natives would call, as the opening round of Formula One. Well, they got the power, they can do whatever they want. We the peeps just want more and more clean, fast, motor racing. After winning the Daytona 24 Hours, Porsche took the top three spots in the WEC season opener. Penske Porsche team took victory in third place, while second place went to the Porsche of Jota team. Race-winning drivers were Kevin Estre, André Lotterer, and Laurens Van Thur. Second place went to Will Stevens, who once upon a time drove in Formula One with Caterham, along with co-driver Callum Ilott, who last year drove in IndyCars, and French driver Norman Nathau. Third, Matt Campbell from Australia, Michael Christensen from Denmark, and Frank McAweeke. So did you watch any of the WEC race?
No, sir. It was at the same time as the Formula One race.
Interesting. Okay, now, how low can you go? Sauber has answered this question. Veteran F1 engineer Paddy Lowe has re-entered the sport through Zero Petroleum, the carbon-neutral synthetic fuel company founded by him. And he, of course, was with McLaren, with Williams. And do you remember, he was in charge when the car and parts did not arrive on time and they were late in pre-season testing, and thence when Claire had to chop-chop on Paddy Lowe. Now, sir, back to Formula One as we take a look back at some of the Bahrain Grand Prix through the sands of time. The first ever Bahrain Grand Prix in 2004 was round three of the season. Winner from pole position and fastest lap from downtown and authority, Michael Schumacher in a Ferrari. Now, this is interesting. I was impressed. There were 20 drivers in the race. Of those 20 drivers, only one of them is still racing in Formula One. And who can it be, Mr. Rogers?
The most machismo of all machismos.
Very true. In 2005 and 2006, the race winner would go on to take the title also at the end of the season, driving for Renault. And the same hombre did a Mario and Arnaiz in Bahrain in 2010. And of course, we're talking about Alonso again. He won on debut for the red team, which Mario Andretti did in 1971 for Ferrari at Kyalami. Mansell did his mojo for the red team in Rio 1989, and later on, the Finnish Kimi Raikkonen would also go on to win on his debut for Ferrari in 2007. Felipe Massa is the only non-European winner of the Bahrain Grand Prix, taking back-to-back victories for Ferrari in 2007 and 2008. In 2009, the race was won by double diffuser dynamo Jenson Button driving for Braun GP. No race in 2010 as the natives were getting restless over human rights and other political issues, which we don't want to get into. Okay, sir, now it's time for us to play part one of our chat in Berlin with Mr. Paul Velasco, a very interesting character from South Africa of Portuguese descent and now living in Berlin. I would like to thank him very much for taking me to Avos Racetrack. We had a great time. Enjoyed some great cuisine, and then I was at his house when we did this conversation. It's a long, detailed conversation. I thank him very much for his time, and today we're going to play part one. So here we go. Okay, folks, I'm here in Berlin, wishing I was riding on the metro, but we have somebody more exciting on board today. Let's say guten Tag to Senor Paul Velasco. Amigo, welcome to the crazy world of F1 Weekly. How are you today?
Hey, Master, how are you, mate? First of all, thank you very much. It's been quite a rollercoaster ride since you and I made virtual contact, and now you're here in the flesh, and it's amazing. I'm absolutely honored and pleased to have met you, obviously. But more than that, I'm honored to be able to be talking to you on a podcast that I'm going to put my hand on my heart, I should have discovered a long time ago. You guys aren't doing a good job with marketing. But anyway, with such fantastic memories and such fantastic interviews, and to be among legends of the sport that you've interviewed for me it's surreal actually.
Meeting people like you is what we call flash for F1 fantasy. It's a great meeting you also. Now, you are serious Mr. International, living in Berlin, originally from South Africa, of Portuguese descent. When I've been going to your website, Grand Prix 247, for quite a while before we connected, and I just had an inkling that you were Portuguese-speaking Brazilian. So give us a little background on little PV growing up in South Africa.
Okay, yeah, well, you know, was born in Mozambique from a Portuguese family. And my grandparents immigrated to South Africa, and when my mom and dad split, we ended up in South Africa. And this was before the revolution, actually. So it wasn't like we were forced out. We just basically immigrated, like one did, because South Africa was a very, you know, good country in terms of prospects for people in that time. So we ended up in South Africa. So in terms of my upbringing, I grew up there. I went to school there. I did my military service there, and I began my career as a photojournalist and a motor racing photographer in that period that I was in South Africa. So, yeah, very much so, like I said, a Portuguese immigrant living in South Africa and benefiting from the good life at the time that we did, you know, and among those things was motorsport.
Now, in 1971, your mom and granddad take you to your first Grand Prix, and the winner is an American driver. How old were you, and what do you remember most from that day?
Okay, I remember nothing, but I've seen the photographs. So that's what actually sparks the memory. But I do know that we were on the outside of barbecue, because the whole of Kyle Army used to be surrounded by scaffoldings. And although there were grandstands that were permanent, but there was a lot of gaps in the space, pretty much like Watkins Glen in the 70s. You know, people built scaffoldings, the cars right up against the fences. And I remember being in barbecue, which wasn't the best corner to be because the cars come flat out through there. But when I say I remember, there's photographs of me standing by a fence. There's my mom barbecuing with my granddad. And so that was my first introduction. And I know my mom was very thrilled to have Mario Andretti on the grid, because women didn't really follow Formula One like they do these days with social media and that. It was more like, oh, he's so dashing, I hope he's fast. And I think she was a Mario Andretti fan, and that's, oddly, he won that race. So it was, yeah, there's a sort of like a weird karma going on, but there we go. First race I ever went to. And I have evidence of, in terms of photos that I've seen, although I can't remember, is the 1971 South African Grand Prix.
Very good. Now, in 1973, not sure if it was mutual epiphany, both of us discovered a new religion, the ideology of high-pitched screams and saints like Peterson, Freddie Parley, Stewart. Tell us about your first introduction and falling in love with Formula One, since you don't remember much from Kyle Army 71.
Yeah. No, it was Christmas when I basically got this book. It was the John Player Special sort of year in review, 1973. And I spent that whole school holidays between Christmas and January learning every page of that book. So although I didn't start at the very beginning of the 1973 season, because I don't remember that far back, I know that when I got that book on the 25th of December, 1973, I didn't put it down. I mean, it was in tatters, because I knew every result, I knew everything. And it was a fantastic battle between Tyrrell versus JPS. Tyrrell would have been, in today's, would have been sort of the Mercedes at their height. JPS would be Red Bull, and they'd be flinging it out with four great drivers, with Emerson Fittipaldi leading the JPS charge, with Ronnie Peterson, his number two, and Jackie Stewart leading the charge with Tyrrell, Savert, his teammate, who was going to be the heir apparent. Anyway, what transpired was that whole tale was just an incredible season. So I can't say I lived Savert's death, although I was aware of it, because I do remember the talk of Savert's death, which was just in October, I think, which was just before Christmas when I got the book. And then reliving all these things and rereading that, it was like watching a DVD all the time, but you're just reading. And it's etched in my mind, you know, some of the great races. some very tragic races. Where we really, in 73, Nasser, you'll know, man, so many people died, so many drivers, and tragically. So yeah, that was the year that I was baptized.
Now, from the 73 season, for me, the one thing I cannot get out of my mind from that season is what happened on Saturday at Watkins Glen, okay, Sivir getting killed. Is there a particular moment, good or bad, negative or positive, or a few moments that stands out for you?
In terms of what?
Anything from the 73 season?
73 season?
What comes to your mind?
Immediately, Roger Purley walking away in desperation from Roger Williamson's burning car and urging the marshals and, you know, that footage.
Oh, yes.
That to me, that immediately is 1973 to me.
Yeah.
It was horrific. It was absolutely horrific. And you're going to correct me if I'm wrong. It was 1973 when Halewood crashed at Crowthorne?
It was.
Because I was there. I remember that very well, and I confirmed that I was there. Because I was there, look, from 71 on. I don't recall 72, but from 71 on, we went to every Grand Prix. We went to every 9-hour. We went to every national race. We went to every regional race. I was at Kyle Army once or twice a month, every month from 1972 on. So in 73, so we were sitting not in Barbecue, but between Barbecue and Crowthorne. And I'm sure that accident happened on the exit of Crowthorne. And you're going to know better, because I've never met a guy with so much knowledge about Formula One like you. But it was that Grand Prix. I believe it was 73. It could have been 72. But it's 73, I'm sure. And there was this big crash. And Stewart was leading, or Stewart was second or something. And he needed to go fast. And while the cars were burning on the circuit, and I think Halewood was involved, if I'm not mistaken, maybe even Howden Ganley, I don't know, you're going to tell me now. Anyway, cut a long story short, I witnessed that, and that was me, also struck me.
Yeah, Jackie Stewart did win that race. Now, how far was Kyalami from your casa in Johannesburg?
20-minute drive, half an hour drive.
And you mentioned to me that, and you just said also that you were there more than once in a month. Now, unfortunately, we had an American driver, Peter Revson, killed at Kyle Army the following season in preseason testing. Were you there that day?
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, that you mentioned it. It shows you how many guys died when we were fans, eh? It was 74, right? It was testing a week before the Grand Prix, if I'm not mistaken. And there was not all the teams were there. There were some. And I know that Peter Revson was there with a shadow. He had driven for Yardley McLaren. Although his parents didn't really support his racing, Yardley did back him, and he was a long, long, as far as I remember, and you're going to clarify for me, he had a long association with McLaren. And UOP, Shadow, which actually the name sort of describes the team, very shadowy, owned by a guy called Don Nicholson. Legend has it he was involved with the CIA. And anyway, you know the story, but the bottom line is, it was a big move. It was a big move for Revson, because he had gone out of his McLaren comfort zone, and it proved to be a bad move, because at the end of the day, it was on a Thursday, I believe, or you'd have to get the dates right, but how my memory serves me now is during testing, he crashed, the car hit the barrier, it caught a light, and the marshals couldn't get him out of the car, and he burned to death in the car. Driver stopped and everything, as they usually do, but there's no footage, there's no nothing. There was very little. The only thing that I do remember very vividly is being at the track at that age, which was, I was about 14 then, 13, 14, and I was 14. It was my birthday's in March, so it was around the same time. The whole Grand Prix, the whole weekend, because we would go there Friday, we'd even probably go there Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Thursday would be in the pits, Friday we'd go to our spot at, between Barbecue and Crowthorne. And I remember just the whole weekend, there was this Armco with a big black splosh. There was this Armco with this big black splosh on it. It was about 300 meters from me. I'm sitting there now and looking, and I can see it 200 meters from me. I'm sitting there, and that was there all the time. And I remember at the time, it actually did think that there was a guy who died there. And it was, yeah, that was quite.
Now, how big was motorsports in South Africa back then? And did they show F1 races live or tape delay? And what was your main source of information? There was no internet, there was no YouTube in our younger days.
Yeah, well, there was not even TV in South Africa until very late in the game. They were very, very late because they felt TV was evil. Anyway, to cut a long story short, look, South Africa had some beautiful things about it in terms of motorsport. First of all, a very, very powerful motorsport community. We used to have what used to be called, this is other races that I attended that I forgot to mention. They used to have the Springbok Series, where drivers would come from all over the world and they'd spend the summer there racing in the various tracks in South Africa, including Kyalami. So a lot of November to January, February, March racing and testing. Kyalami was a hub for testing, so there was a lot of testing. In those days, testing was like that. Teams would come to a place called Kyalami Ranch, and there'd be one car from each team, and it would be the major teams and a couple of maybe stragglers. And every year, they would come spend 2 weeks there. And you can go every day and just bump. I've got photos that you just bump into driver Keke Rosberg sitting tanning on the pit lane with a cigarette in his hand. And, you know, just guys playing soccer. And, you know, there was none of this corporate stuff, and the access was is unbelievable in those days. And, yeah, so we were sort of fed on this, what we thought was normal, is just constant testing and going to watch the cars and being there, fly on the wall. So, yeah, it was constant. And then, of course, they had the Grand Prix. They had the World Endurance Championship at one stage with the Kyalami 9-hour and the 6-hour. Ronnie Peterson drove there. I remember Ronnie Peterson driving around the outside of a Matra around Crowthorne. He was driving a BMW CSL 3-litre, a black thing, and man, it was pouring with rain, and he was just overtaking the Matra prototype like it was standing still. It was beautiful, you know. So you got to see the drivers, you got to mix with them. So yeah, it was just part of my life, all my life, and I can only thank my grandfather for it, because he was the one. He wasn't a very talkative guy, but you know, he loved Formula One, he loved motor racing, and he took me to all the races. Had all the Autosports, which was very important, and the Motorsport magazine. So that was my library. Because a week after it appeared in the shelves in the UK, I got the Autosport. And I devoured Autosports, you know, one week to the other.
Believe it or not, I used to listen to Radio South Africa, and I remember distinctly South African Grand Prix, which they would cover, used to be on Saturdays in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember, I think it was the race that Niki Lauda won, and commentator said, you know, Niki Lauda blazing away in the red Ferrari, and I still remember that. And I remember following one day, which I did a couple of years on the radio, Kyalami 9 hours, which in those days was a pretty major event. Now, unfortunately, there was more tragedy at Kyalami in 1976. Tell us where you were on the track and what you witnessed.
In 1976, I was in boarding school. I was 16 then, and most of my mates were 16. Carl Axman, Graham Hope, Graham Gentile, Sean Mulvaney, Elias de Gouveia. I remember them all. And we basically, my friend Carl Axman, his dad was a car dealer, so we had this VW combi. We called it a combi. It was like a microbus. We packed the bottom with beers, and we got scaffoldings, and off we went. And we couldn't find a place, and we got there late, so the only place we could find was the inside of Crowthorne Corner. Like, as they hit the brakes and they start to apex, as they start turning in, we found a spot and we built this like 3-story high wobbly scaffolding right by the fence with a bucky, which is like a pickup, right up against it to hold it. And we built this thing up. As schoolboys, this was the first time, I think, yeah, definitely the first time I was not sitting with my grandfather. I was actually sitting with my mates. And anyway, Grand Prix's on. Suddenly, you hear this noise and scratching and stuff, and you don't even see anything. Boom! The car there, straight into the catch fences. Those catch fences just rippled the car up, and boom, into the wall. Then another car, boom, over it. I look, Ligier, Lafitte, there, shadow, Tom Price. Wow, what happened there? Helicopter, people going, wow, sand all over the guy, the medics. Anyway, cut a long story short, we were like 50 meters from that accident. It happened right in front of us, everything. It was that tragic story of Tom Price hitting a marshal, and only afterwards when we got home, I mean, you know, there was no TV screens, and, you know, you could hardly hear the commentators. It was just like absolute mayhem in terms of that. The car didn't even stop, carried on to such a point that at the end of that race, Niki Lauda ended up with Tom Price's roll bar stuck under his car. So, you know, it was just ballistic stuff. And in terms of us, we only later realized what actually happened. And I think only, when the thing happened, no one knew for minutes, I would imagine, from reports, that the marshal was hit. And basically what happened is Renzo Zorzi, in a shadow, sponsored by the mafia, actually, that shadow team was Ambrosini, which was a whole big, another scandal. But anyway, so this thing stops on the main straight, in front of the main grandstand, and it's burning. Renzo pops out and he's calling for marshals and stuff, and they fling two marshals across the road. Now, if anyone knows Kyalami has a brow. As you hit the start-finish line, it starts to dip slightly, and then it dips more and more, and then it goes down the hill. There's a point where if you're low in a car, you don't see the entire hedge of the brow. This is when I think they launched the marshals. Two marshals ran, the Van Vierens. I believe they were brothers. Janssen Van Vieren, I think his name was. Anyway, the first marshal got past, and the second marshal just got whacked. Boom. He got whacked so hard, he just disintegrated, mate. If you look carefully at the thing, he's like a rag, like a towel. It's flung into a corner, bomb. And, of course, we only saw this on TV later. We didn't realize this was the impact. So now Tom Price is now dead because his helmet hit the fire extinguisher that the marshal was carrying. And that fire extinguisher they found on the other side of the grandstand, which is anyone who knows that grandstand, it's like a good 20 meters high and 50 meters to go over it. That's how hard he hit that thing. Then the shadow went and hit the barrier about 300 meters from where we were, and then came back onto the track, on the inside of the track, came back onto the track, and just narrowly missed Lafitte, and boom, 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 it's all chaos thereafter. So that was it, another death, you know, it's like...
And you are in that famous picture that was taken at the track when he is just after his crash. You had sent me an image that some, you know, like you said, schoolboy standing on the...
Yeah.
You are in that.
Yeah, image. That actually, the pictures where you see Tom's car flying, there's a scaffolding there, that was our scaffolding.
Wow, unbelievable.
Yeah, it's just...
Okay, now, the race was won by Niki Lauda, and many years later, in 2013, while you were working at the Dubai Autodrome, you mentioned this to him when he and Adrian Newey came to the track. Can you share that?
That was an interesting day, you know. The Dubai Autodrome, in those days, we used to get a lot of Formula One people coming, swinging by, because we have a really, really good kart track. Kartdrome. If you're in Dubai, you've got to go to the Dubai Kartdrome, you've got to go to the Autodrome. It's really a... It's good to see, and now it's like 20 years old, so it's not like it's a new thing. And they really got that kart drum working really well. And, of course, its reputation preceded itself, and Niki Lauda arrives there with Adrian Newey's son, and a couple of other people from Red Bull. And we got talking, and, you know, Niki obviously went on the kart. Now, there's a rule in that kart drum, and David Bright, who was the manager who took over from David Terrien, who started the track. But David actually insists, and it was a rule, you have to wear a race suit provided by the kart drum to get on the track. Niki said, no, I'm not going to do it. So he's the only guy I know to this day who went on the kart drum with short sleeves, a polo shirt and jeans. And he did some laps. And then afterwards, Adrian Newey and his son did some laps. But while they were doing those laps, I told Niki that James Hunt's McLaren was actually in the pits in our garage. And he said, let's go see it. So off we went and we saw it. And it was an interesting moment. We talked about that incident. He talked about the roll bar. Actually, he was the one who verified it for me. I've seen it in photos before. And it was just an interesting moment with Niki.
Now, how long did you work in Dubai?
Dubai, I arrived there in 2004 as the photo director of Golf News. I spent 3 years with them. And then from 2008 until 2016, I was the communication manager at Dubai Autodrome.
Cool. And at that time, how developed was the local motorsports scene? Because I know it's very big now. They have Grand Prix a few in that area. And I've been to the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix a few times. You hardly see any locals there. In terms of young kids who come and take part, do you see a growth in interest among locals who were born and raised there, not from, you know, other parts of the world?
Well, I think you have to tackle this in two issues. First of all, when I arrived, the racing culture just arrived, and Dubai Autodrome was built. It was a magnificent facility, one of the nicest racetracks I've ever seen, actually, and driven, to be honest. And not that I've driven many, many, but of the drivers, I know it's a favorite. And this track emerged in the desert. I think initially it was with Grand Prix aspirations, but it was a grade one track that had to be built as part of a program with a property developer called Union Properties. And they developed the track and they built it and they spent a lot of money on it. But there was no grassroots motorsports organized, etc. Apart from rally and off-road, which had some sort of infrastructure, the whole infrastructure for racing on tracks was not pretty much non-existent. And Dubai Autodrome kind of led that with the local scene and tried to build the local scene. But it was difficult. And there was a lot of local interest, and there were local teams and drivers, some very good local drivers, and a lot of money spent. So that's what it boils down to. A lot of money was pumped into it, and you can see now. I'm super impressed. I'm super not surprised, actually. In a way, surprised because of the speed. But since I left, there's been a whole immense boom in the sport. And I think the foundation was set. And after that foundation was set, after the 10 years that they're in for the ride now, I'm super, super impressed with what the Middle East is doing for the sport. Irrespective of the politics and things like that, I think I've never seen the sport grow so fast and so professionally in terms of numbers, in terms of everything, as it has grown in the UAE since I was there in 2004.
Okay, one of the clients of your agency was Marlboro, and through this connection, you got to know man with the yellow helmet. Do you remember your first meeting with Senna? And I'm assuming, being of Portuguese descent, you can speak the Portuguese language. That must have helped in communicating with him.
Yeah, no, the Marlboro thing came about as 1988. I wanted to... tired of doing news photography in South Africa. It was time to move on. I tried some projects with racing, managing some bike guys, but I wanted to pursue my photography. And maybe I phoned Marlboro one day and I just said, look, and in those days you phoned, you had faxes at best. And I was basically told a guy called Jeff Hutchinson was their media and photography guy. Jeff Hutchinson, he worked with a guy called Jad Sharif. Another photographer, both good photographers, and but more Jad the photographer and Jeff the words man. They needed another photographer to do MotoGP and to help out with Formula One. So they said, well, get your ass here and come here and then we'll do it. So I got there in 88 and Jeff told me to buy a motorhome to do this project. So I bought a motorhome, which was a big mistake. Drove to Imola for the first time for testing. They used to do testing at Imola then. And there was Ferrari and there was McLaren and all the major teams were there and Senna was there. And my job was to photograph Senna. So that's what I did. I spent the whole 3 or 4 days that were there. He wasn't big into testing, but it was very close to the start of the season. So it was his first test. It was actually his test back from Angra dos Reis, where he had spent some time. One day it was raining. It was really pissing with rain. And I'd been around the garage. He had seen me and whatever. And then while it was raining, there were still people in the grandstands. And every time Ferrari opened the garage, the grandstand erupted. And when the garage closed, they went boo. And this was the whole day going on like this. Anyway, so I walked down to the end of the pit lane just to check this, you know, just to walk around. And suddenly when I turned around, there's a guy next to me with a red jacket and Aiton. And he smiles at me and says, hey, how are you doing? I see you around and blah, blah. I said, yeah. And we started speaking. And I told him I'm from South Africa, but I'm Portuguese. And we started speaking to Portuguese and... yeah, and it was a really cool kind of like 2 to 3, 4, 5 minute exchange. Wouldn't be longer than 5 minutes, but a 3 to 4 minute exchange. And then it turned to Portuguese, actually, afterwards, and we spoke. And that's how I met him. That's how I engaged with him for the first time. And thereafter, for the next 2 years or so that I was there, I was constant presence in the pits or behind. And, you know, no bullshit. Whenever I saw Senna for the first time on a day, he'd always give me a thumbs up, a wink, or whatever. You know what I mean? It was just, that's the way it was. I mean, it wasn't like today, oh, I want a selfie with you. And I was in awe of the guy. You know, he has a guard getting in the car, and I'm taking photos, and he's giving me a thumbs up. You know, it was super. It was like, it was how it should be, you know, how hockey wise at the racetrack. I didn't get to know him beyond that, but I did get to be in his space quite a lot, as you were in those days, as any photographer is, like the guys who cover Max Verstappen today. You know, you look at the Getty guys, they get brilliant stuff. And they're also hearing, you're also hearing them talk, you're hearing people talk about them. So you're absorbing all this information while you're working in the presence of greatness. It was fantastic. It was the first meeting. That was the first meeting, Emma. Yeah.
Paul, we will see you next week on podcast 1035. Nasser?
Yes, sir. Before we wrap it up with famous last words, would you have anything to say, any observation, or your favorite question? Your prediction, who will win the race? After Max crosses the check finish line first?
Yes, and once we get the Jetta, it's going to be a mess. The Red Bull situation with Christian Horner is going to be lingering. People are going to be bitter. Max might boycott the race, and Fernando will win.
Oh, wow. I hope it happened. That would be great. Okay, sir, now we come to famous last words. Today, they come from Toto Wolff, and he was talking about Max Verstappen.
Jojo, how do you feel after that? A bit disappointed, 45 seconds off the win?
Yeah, far off. I mean, Max was in a different galaxy. We need to look at ourselves, why we lost so much performance on the harder tyre. We got the cooling level wrong, and therefore you need to lift and coast. You lose performance on the tyres. It was a bit of a vicious circle.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Good night.